This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. A police state is how Walter Cronkite described Chicago in 1968 when the Democratic Convention was about to begin there. Anti-war demonstrators had gathered in Chicago's Lincoln Park. Mayor Daley issued a curfew and had denied the protesters a permit to sleep in the park. When demonstrators decided to violate the curfew, the police responded by charging into them. This led to several days of confrontations, during which police tear-gassed demonstrators and beat them with billy clubs. The government blamed 8 leaders of the anti-war movement who were indicted on charges of conspiracy to incite riot. My guest Brett Morgan has directed a new film called Chicago 10 about the conspiracy trial. It uses archival footage from many sources and recreates the trial through animation using the voices of such actors as Roy Scheider, Mark Ruffalo, Liev Schreiber, and Hank Azaria. Cameras were not allowed into the trial, but Morgan discovered an audio tape, and he's brought an excerpt with him. We think this will be the first time it's ever been broadcast. Here's an example of the fascinating archival footage he included in the film. It's a montage of a meeting from a 1968 meeting of the protest organizers. You'll hear the voices of Tom Hayden, Abby Hoffman, Rennie Davis, and Ed Sanders.
We have to establish a network for discussion and preparation that takes into account the possibility that you might want, at the time of the convention, a very great outpouring of protest, or the other possibility that you might want protests to occur on a more moderate scale at the convention and in other parts of the country.
We believe that politics is the way you live your life, not who you support. It's not in terms of rallies or speeches or political programs. It's in terms of images and in terms of transforming people's lives.
We are coming to Chicago at the time of the Democratic National Convention, not to disrupt the convention, not to confront the police, National Guard troops, or men of the United States Army, but to challenge the policies of militarization that have been felt so strongly and brutally in Vietnam.
We're going to invest our time, our semen, our love vectors, our intellect in America, and we're not going to allow our country to become one of the fabled damned of nations, to join the Mayan ruins and all the other violent civilizations that have been snuffed.
Brett Morgan, welcome to Fresh Air. People know of the Chicago 7 trial. Your movie is called Chicago 10. Why have you called it that?
Well, you know, it was originally the trial of the Chicago 8, and a few months into the case, Bobby Seale was severed, and it became then known as the Chicago 7. But I came across a quote from Jerry Rubin at some point in which he said, "Anyone who calls us the Chicago 7 is a racist because you're not acknowledging the presence of Bobby Seale. So call us the Chicago 8, but really you should call us the Chicago 10 because our two attorneys, Lem Weinglass and Bill Kunstler, went down with us."
And they were sentenced to contempt.
Kunstler was sentenced to 4.5 years of contempt. I think Weinglass got 1.5. And ultimately, the movie is really about appropriating this time period and rendering it as something new. So we decided to rebrand it as the Chicago 10.
Now, before we talk more about how you've made your movie, let's just talk a little bit more about the event itself for anybody who doesn't remember it well or wasn't alive at the time. The demonstration in Lincoln Park at the time of the 1968 Democratic National Convention, it was more than just a demonstration. Abby Hoffman, one of the organizers, described it as total theater, a festival of life. Just talk a little bit about what the intentions were of the organizers.
Well, this was one of the problems with the conspiracy trial in which the government tried to suggest that there was sort of a singular motivation behind the movement. There were a number of different groups that wanted to protest in Chicago, and they wanted to exercise their constitutional right to assemble and protest the convention that was happening in the amphitheater. Basically, as early as March of 68, these various organizations approached the city for permits. And Daley, from the get-go, refused to give anyone permits to protest. I think his feeling was he was using the convention as a way to showcase the city. He had spent a great deal of time and money sort of in these beautification efforts. And I think in his mind, the protesters would sort of pollute and dirty that image. So no matter what they did, he refused to allow them any permits. And sometime during this process, I think it was in April, after Dr. King was assassinated and they had the riots, Mayor Daley gave the famous shoot to kill order, in which he basically told the assembled media that he was ordering the police to shoot and kill anyone who was involved in any larceny or rioting. And that was kind of an effort to scare the protesters from coming to Chicago. And in fact, it did. But ultimately, there were two main groups that we focus on in the film, the Yippies and the Mobilization. The Mobilization, which was fronted by Rennie Davis, Tom Hayden, and David Dellinger, wanted to do more of a traditional protest in the parks of Chicago. The Yippies, on the other hand, wanted to create a festival of life, as they put it, a celebration of life in the shadows of the convention of death. And what they had envisioned was a three-day sort of Woodstock festival, if you will, with bands like the Rolling Stones and the Beatles, and a sort of merging of the hippie countercultural movement with the new left.
Well, the police confronted the demonstrators in the park. They charged them. They tear gassed them. They beat them. And tell us what the charges were at the Chicago 7 trial.
Right. So
Chicago
after
8.
After being, the riots in Chicago, we can't even really call them riots because I think the proper terminology is they were police riots. It was really the police going berserk. And for 5 days, they senselessly attacked the demonstrators in a manner that was as vicious as, in my mind, the Rodney King beatings, just on a massive scale. So 3 months after the convention, Nixon won office, and one of the first things that John Mitchell did was indict the leaders of the anti-war movement for conspiracy with crossing state lines with the intent to start a riot. This was, ironically, a new law that was part of the Civil Rights Act. The Chicago 8 are the only people who've ever been tried under the Civil Rights Act and were the first people ever tried it and the only people ever tried under it.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Brett Morgan. His new movie is called The Chicago 10, and it's about the demonstrations in Chicago during the Democratic National Convention and the conspiracy trial, the Chicago 8 trial, that followed it. Your movie is not told with interviews. There aren't witnesses describing what happened. Your movie is made with a combination of footage shot on the scene at the time and animation of the actual trial. And why did you turn to animation of the actual trial?
Well, the film takes a very Yippie-centric view of history. And firstly, the reason we didn't do interviews is a number of the participants have since died. And I didn't feel that it was right to allow the surviving members to own the story just by virtue of the fact that they were fortunate enough to have survived to this point. And I also didn't want this
instance,
to be...
For instance, Abby Hoffman's dead, Jerry Rubin's dead, so two of the key people would not have their voices represented.
Bill Kunstler, Dave Dellinger, Judge Hoffman, yeah, Thomas Foran. So, so that was one. The other thing is I didn't want this to be a film about... aging boomers looking back on their lives. I wanted the audience to see the participants as they were at the time as 20-year-olds and kids in their early 30s.
So, okay, and then the trial itself you do through animation. There were no cameras in the courtroom, so you have no documentary footage of the actual trial.
Correct. And for a while, I was trying to figure out how to present the trial, and I came across a quote from Jerry Rubin in which he described the trial as a cartoon show, and the proverbial light bulb went off in my head, and I said, that's perfect. This trial was like a circus. I mean, it was very over the top and animated to begin with, so it seemed like that would be the perfect style to represent it.
Well, I want to give a sense of how you've managed to cast this, and we can't show the animation itself, but we can hear what you've done. And you've sent us a clip of what the actual trial sounded like. I have never heard what the actual trial sounded like. So it's kind of amazing to listen in. I didn't know that there were audio tapes. Where did you get this audio tape from?
Well, during the course of our research, we spent 3 years trying to collect every piece of media that existed on this subject, and that took us pretty much all over the world. And we amassed, I think, over 1,200 hours of film, 60-millimeter film, 500-plus hours of audio, and 14,000 photographs. And at an archive house in Chicago, we found some unlabeled tapes that we put on, and they ended up being courtroom audio, which was shocking to me because every person we spoke to basically said that they didn't exist. I believe the court reporter had recorded these. The people were speaking so frenetically in the courtroom that it was, I think, hard for her to keep up, and so she started to record some of the events. And it was a revelation to me because after reading the 23,000-page transcript and trying to imagine some of these voices, and particularly Judge Hoffman, obviously with Bill Kunstler and some of the other characters, there was a ton of archival footage that I could look at to understand how they spoke and their reflection and diction.
Did you have like the whole trial or just like excerpts of it?
No, we had, you know, there were a number of reels, a lot of which were a bit wobbly and difficult to understand. But we did have a good chunk of the stuff that we were covering in the film. So it was a great tool for us to use, particularly for Roy Scheider, who was playing Judge Hoffman.
Well, this is really going to be interesting. We're going to play an excerpt of your movie with actors portraying the people at the Chicago 8 trial, and then we're going to hear the tape from the actual trial. So let's start with the excerpt of your movie. And again, this is an animated excerpt. And this is the day of the National Vietnam Moratorium. So right before Judge Hoffman enters the court, Dave Dellinger, who's a pacifist and was a leader of an anti-war group, gets up to, and he's one of the defendants, he gets up to address the people in the court before the judge enters. And he explains that the moratorium is a day to protest the continuation of the war and to urge the withdrawal of U.S. forces in Vietnam. And he says that in observance of the moratorium and to kind of get the sense of the people who are dying senselessly in the war, he's going to read the names of the people who have died in the war this week. So he starts reading the names. And at this point, the court is called to order. Judge Hoffman comes in. And then the prosecutor objects to Dellinger's little speech. And then Kunstler, the defense attorney, objects to the prosecutor. We're going to pick it up as Judge Hoffman has walked in and Dave Dellinger wants to continue speaking.
Mr. Hoffman, we are observing the moratorium.
I am Judge Hoffman, sir.
I believe in equality, sir. So I prefer to call people Mr. or by their first names.
You will sit down, sir.
Can I be heard,
Your Honor? I object to this man speaking out in court.
We would like to propose a moment of silence.
You needn't object. I forbid him to disrupt the proceedings.
Your Honor, I want to object to Mr. Ferrand's yelling in the presence of the jury. Your Honor has admonished...
Your Honor, this is outrageous. This man is a mouthpiece. Look at him. He's wearing an armband of his clients. The government protests his attitude and requests the court move to take notice of his conduct.
Your Honor, I think that the temper and the expression on Mr. Ferrand's face speaks more than any picture could tell.
My contempt for Mr. Kunstler.
Mr. Kunstler.
To call me a mouthpiece and for your honor not to open his mouth and say that's not to be done in your court, I think violates the sanctity of this court. That is a word your honor knows is contemptuous and contumacious.
Don't tell me what I know.
I want him admonished, Your Honor, and I request you to do that.
I do not admonish the United States attorney because he was properly representing his client, the United States of America.
To call another attorney a mouthpiece.
You, a lawyer, permitting your client to stand up in the presence of the jury and disrupt these proceedings. I don't know how to characterize it.
Your Honor, we do not permit or not permit our clients. They are free, independent human beings who have been brought by the government
That's
to
right.
this courtroom.
They're free, but they'll conform to the law, and they'll conform to the direction of the court here, sir.
Are you turning down my request?
I not only turn it down, I ignore it.
That speaks louder than words.
That's an excerpt of the new film, The Chicago 10, made by my guest, Brett Morgan. And we heard Roy Scheider as Judge Hoffman. Who else did we hear in that scene, Brett?
That was Nick Nolte as Prosecutor Thomas Foran, Dylan Baker as David Dellinger, and Liev Schreiber as Bill Kunstler.
Now, we're going to hear an excerpt of the actual trial, a real audio recording made at the trial that you've brought with you. And before we hear it, is there anything in particular you'd like us to listen for?
The judge's voice, I mean, two things to listen to. Thomas Foran.
The prosecutor.
The prosecutor and the way that he is just absolutely exploding in the courtroom and the inflection of Judge Hoffman's voice is a very unique characteristic that Roy spent a lot of time trying to mimic.
Okay, so we're going to pick up this part of the real tape with the prosecutor objecting to Dave Dellinger's speaking about the Vietnam moratorium.
I forbid him to disrupt the proceeding. I note for the record that his name is
David Dellinger.
You needn't fill out my sentences for me, sir.
I
note for the record that the name of this man who has attempted to disrupt the proceedings in this court is David T. Dellinger, and the record will clearly indicate that. Miss Reporter, and I direct him and all the others not to repeat such occurrence.
Your Honor, I just want to object to Mr. Foran yelling in the presence of the jury. Your Honor has admonished many counsel many times on the defense side for yelling, but particularly when the jury was halfway out the door.
I never used the word yelling.
Raising your voice.
If a lawyer representing his client didn't protest that sort of thing, he'd be a mighty poor lawyer for his client.
But not in the presence of that jury, which was deliberately done, Your Honor, as that door was
open. Your Honor, that is outrageous. This man is a mountain. Look at his words, a man like his client. Your Honor, any lawyer who comes into a courtroom and has no respect for the court and acts in conjunction with that kind of conduct before the court, Your Honor, the government protests this attitude and would like the state to move the court to make note of this conduct before this court.
Note has been duly made on the record.
Your Honor, I think that the temper and the tone of voice and the expression on Mr. Foran's face speaks more than any picture you could tell.
Mr.
Counselor,
to call me a mouthpiece. And Your Honor, not to open his mouth and say that's not to be done in your court, I think violates the sanctity of this court. That is a word that Your Honor knows is contemptuous and contumacious.
Don't tell me what I know.
Well, then you tell me, Your Honor. You better hear that word used in your court before.
Here, Mr.
Wearing an armband in memoriam to dead, Your Honor, is no disgrace in this country. I want to admonish, Your Honor, I request you to do that. The word mouthpiece is a contemptuous term.
Let the record show. Did you say you want to admonish me?
No, I want you to admonish him.
I do not admonish the United States Attorney because he was properly representing his client, the United States of America.
That's an excerpt of the actual Chicago 8 trial, a real audio tape of the trial. And I guess Brett Morgan has just made a movie about the trial, and he thinks this is the first time this tape has ever publicly been played. Brett, what kind of revelation was it for you to actually hear real tape like this, as opposed to reading the transcripts or seeing dramatic reenactments that have been made before?
I've heard Judge Hoffman's voice described as the voice of death, but I think it's very I never had heard a voice quite like it. I mean, in one hand, he's being condescending and patronizing to the defendants. On the other hand, at points, he sounds very feeble and weak. The defendants we commonly refer to him as Mr. Magoo or Elmer Fudd, but I don't think those descriptions do justice to that unique quality of that voice. So hearing it, I think was a huge bolt of inspiration for Scheider and myself. I also think with Thomas Foran, I would have never from reading the transcripts.
Again, this is the prosecutor.
Correct, the prosecutor. I would have never guessed that he would be screaming at the top of his lungs in the courtroom. But you can hear how much the defendants have got underneath his skin. But it's funny, you know, when we first premiered, the film was the opening night film at the Sundance Film Festival last year. And a couple of the critics, you know, took issue with the depiction of the courtroom. And they would say it's completely over the top and one-sided or what have you. And they were obviously making that comment from I hate to say it, but a point of ignorance, because no one really, unless they were in the courtroom, had any idea what those voices sounded like. And this is the thing about the trial, is that it's so outrageous, it's hard to believe it really happened. And these characters were – you could not cast a story like this. I mean, the fact that Judge Hoffman got assigned to in that courtroom in the context of this history is just – it's incredible.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Brett Morgan, director of the new documentary Chicago 10. It's about the Chicago 8 or 7 conspiracy trial, in which leaders of the movement against the war in Vietnam were charged with conspiracy to riot in Chicago in 1968, when Chicago was the site of the Democratic National Convention. The movie uses archival footage of police attacking demonstrators and of the events leading up to the confrontations. The film uses animation to recreate excerpts of the trial. No cameras were allowed in the courtroom, but Morgan did find an audio tape of the trial, which we played an excerpt of just before the break. You know, watching the movie, I remember the trial, not that I was there, but I certainly remember coverage of it and how important it was and what a real circus it was. Watching the movie, I was kind of surprised at my reaction because, although I think Judge Hoffman was so wrong for this case, he didn't comprehend what was happening at all. He didn't comprehend how or why the people who were on trial were playing him and trying to turn this into political theater. And so all of his reactions were so kind of tone deaf to what was happening and just kind of like feeding, the theater as opposed to getting control of the court. But there was a part of me that almost felt for him because, like, what was he supposed to do? Like, everybody was playing him. Everybody was trying to make it into political theater. And you feel him, you know, like, trying to keep control of the court and being clueless about how to do it.
Well, I will tell you that's a credit to Roy Scheider. When we did the recordings with Roy, I was out in the Hamptons with him in a little recording booth. And we would listen to the tapes and we'd do some lines. And Roy, you know, would try to match the judge's inflections, but clearly brought his own interpretation to the role. And I remember when I cut the dialogue, I called him the next day and I said, listen, I think you might have played the judge too nicely. And we should maybe go back and make it a little harsher around the edges here and there. And Roy said, you know, I really respect you as a director, but I'm going to have to tell you no, that this is how I interpret the voice and this is how I think it should be played. And I think Roy was totally right. And I think that he found a way to empathize with the judge that came through in the film. And you do get the sense that, you know, the judge has completely lost control. And by the end of the film, even he, you could get the sense that he wishes he was somewhere else. But I will say, Terry, in all fairness, that the defendants didn't march into the courtroom thinking of this as a big piece of theater. I think there was a lot of division amongst the defendants on how to approach the case. But I think Abby and Jerry's reactions to the judge and the fact that they would often speak out in court had a lot to do with the way the judge handled the case in the early days. And he was so biased against the prejudiced against the defendants. I think that Judge Hoffman, who was, you know, in his last days, saw the defendants as a disease that was polluting America. And it was his moral obligation to cut the head off that snake, very similar to Mayor Daley. And in that sense, I always thought of this as a film as much about parenting and generation gap as it was about cultural revolution. I grew up in a house with a father who would say things like, you know, as long as you're living in my house, you live under my rules. When you're 18, you could do whatever you want, but you're going to look like me and dress like me and fit the part. And I just felt that Judge Hoffman and Mayor Daley refused to identify with the youth and understand them. And by the way, it goes both ways to a certain extent. There was just a total communication breakdown in Chicago. And I think it happened in the months leading up to the convention and then was very much mirrored by the experiences in that courtroom.
I think like the most outrageous moment of the Chicago 8 trial, which you depict in the animated part of your movie, is when Bobby Seale is being spoken of by the prosecutor and he insists on representing himself, on speaking for himself. His lawyer is sick and isn't there, and he is being charged with things that he says he is innocent of, and he wants to speak out. The judge refuses to let him speak. Seale insists on speaking. So the judge finally does the most outrageous thing a judge can do. He has Bobby Seale bound and gagged and brought back into the courtroom. He tells a marshal to take him out. The marshal bounds and gags him, brings him back. This made news around the world. How did you think through depicting that particular chapter of the trial in your animation?
Well, it was a number of things. One, the Seale was severed from the case about 6 weeks in. And one of the problems with the dramatizations I'd seen of Chicago is when you have Bobby Seale severed in the end of Act One, there's not a lot of place you can go with the story. And so one of the great things my editor, Stuart Levy, brought to my attention, he said, why don't we use Bobby for the climax, reconstruct the chronology of the trial, and intercut Bobby being silenced by the judge with the protesters who are trying to march the Conrad Hilton, who are being silenced by the police and being told they can't march. And in that context, it becomes more of a statement about freedom of speech than it does about the inherent racism that was happening in that courtroom. One is not mutually exclusive of the other, but certainly within the context that we presented in the film, we were drawing parallels to what was happening outside the courtroom.
So tell us who you got to play Bobby Seale and why you chose him.
For Bobby Seale, we reached out to Jeffrey Wright, and he had a very difficult role. I mean, most of his character, he's gagged, and it was a very uncomfortable recording session to that extent. I mean, one of the things with all of the performers in the film is we had no money to pay them, and so we tried to make the experience as convenient for them as possible. So I would call their managers and say, listen, I just need about 2 or 3 hours of your client's time. You know, would they be willing to do this for us? So Jeffrey walked into the room and, you know, we make some quick introductions. He has a limited amount of time. And next thing you know, I'm throwing him into one of the most dramatic moments that anyone could play in a U.S. courtroom.
So did you actually gag him?
I think that Jeffrey actually did it with his hand, with like a fist in his mouth. You know, he would take his own, not my fist, he would take his own fist and sort of put it in his mouth and make those sounds.
Why don't we hear a scene from your animated recreation of a Bobby Seale chapter of the trial with Jeffrey Wright as Bobby Seale.
I want to request again, demand again, that I be able to cross-examine the witness. Now, you have Benjamin Franklin and George Washington sitting in pictures behind you, and they were slave owners. That's what they were. They owned slaves. And you acted in the same manner by denying me my constitutional right.
Young man, if you...
Look, old man, you're being exposed to the public and to the world that you don't want to...
Have him sit down, Mr. Marshall.
I want to defend myself. I have the right to speak on behalf of my constitutional rights.
I didn't think I would ever live to sit on a bench in a courtroom where George Washington was assailed by a defendant and a judge was criticized for having his portrait on the wall.
The law protects my right not to be discriminated against. Why don't you recognize that?
Mr. Seale, do you want to stop? Or do you want me to...
You can't deny me my rights! You can't deny me my constitutional rights!
Take that defendant into the room, in there, and deal with him as he should be dealt with.
I still want to be represented. I want to represent myself. Let me go. I want to represent myself. It's my constitutional right. I got a right. I got a right. I got a right.
That's Jeffrey Wright as Bobby Seale in one of the animated scenes from, I guess, Brett Morgan's new movie, Chicago 10, which is a movie about the trial and the demonstrations that led to the trial. So of all the footage that you went through, the network news footage, the alternative filmmakers news footage, and you got access to Haskell Wexler's footage that he shot for the movie Medium Cool, what was the most shocking or just revelatory moments that you saw?
It was really difficult to look at the footage of the beatings in Chicago. Nothing really prepared me for it. And you know, even experiencing that footage for the 3 years that we were working on the film, I never became numb or immune to it. And I don't think there was a day that my editor and I wouldn't shed a tear in the edit room. I had not in my lifetime seen anything close to it. I mean, it was absolutely shocking to experience this footage and to actually see the unedited material where you can see sort of a cop approaching the cameraman and hitting the cameraman. Then you remember, my God, that's a journalist he's hitting, which happened repeatedly. But probably the most powerful image for me in the film was the lady in pink, Mary Kerr, who was a member of the British Parliament who came to Chicago as an observer to observe our wonderful democracy at play. And she was sleeping at the Conrad Hilton Hotel, and apparently was gas came into her room, and so she went downstairs to see what was going on. And I vividly remember she was wearing this pink nightgown. And she walks onto the street, and the second she enters the street, a cop comes up and maces her. And she continues to move towards him, protesting. They manhandle her and try to throw her in the back of a squad car. And as they're trying to push her in, she's singing We Shall Overcome. And this is this, you know, like I said, 65, 70-year-old woman in her nightgown who is an absolutely innocent bystander who was getting, you know, beat up viciously by the police. And that voice of hers singing at the top of her lungs, We Shall Overcome, was I think, one of the most endearing images of Chicago.
How did you know what the backstory was of that footage?
Through my research, I read, and she testified at the trial, and she talked specifically about those events that I just described, so we drew the connection. I mean, there wasn't anyone else that really looked like her, to be honest, in the archival footage. I mean, she really stood out as being in her nightgown and being, I think, close to 70 years old, and watching the police manhandle her was just vicious.
There were parts of the demonstration where demonstrators, as they were being beaten by the police, shouted, "The whole world is watching." And did you really get that feeling going through all this footage, like the impact that it made for the world to see this?
Well, it's an interesting question, because what the world saw in 1968 is not what the world will see through my film.
What do you mean?
I watched all of the broadcast of the riots, and except for the last one in front of the Conrad Hilton, you know, there was an electrical strike in Chicago that week. So there was very limited video remote feeds going on. And so in general, what the networks would do is they would send one camera down to a riot to cover it. And then 4 hours later, they would air maybe 45 seconds up to 2 minutes of unedited footage from one perspective. So the march to the Conrad Hilton at the end was culled from over 50 visual sources and over 20 audio sources. And so the events that we're depicting them are really not what the world saw in 1968. What's shocking to audiences when I speak with them about the film is that 70% of America at the time supported Mayor Daley. And the only thing I could explain to them is, you know, the America was presented with a specific image of these riots, and it really took 40 years for us to come around and reconstruct them.
Through the trial segments of the interview, you have Abbie Hoffman being interviewed by phone by Bob Fass, who was a famous New York talk show host on the Pacifica radio station in New York, WBAI. Are you using actual tapes of the broadcast for that, or are those reenactments?
I am, and just for the record, Bob is still on the air at WBAI on Thursday nights, which is amazing. He's been doing it for, I think, started in 60, 61. Bob was a founder of Yippie, and with Abby and was one of Abby's closest friends. And when people wanted to know what was happening, they would listen to Bob Fass's show. And in 1968, a few months before the convention in Chicago, the Yippie staged an event called the Grand Central Yip-In. And this really was orchestrated by Bob Fass. I mean, Bob would get on the air, tell people tomorrow we're going to meet at Grand Central Station, and then broadcast live during the riots at the Grand Central Station or the sit-in at the Grand Central Station. It's totally remarkable. Almost every night during the trial, Abby would call Bob. Now, you got to remember, Bob's show's on from midnight to 5 a.m. So this was the middle of the night for Abby. He had been, he would be up in the courtroom at 8 a.m. So by the time Abby got on the phone with Bob, he was rather exhausted. And I think he would forget that he was speaking to a live radio audience. And he would just act as if he was just speaking to his good buddy, sort of telling him what was going on. But one of the great things about Abby is he had an incredible sense of humor. And even at 3 in the morning, as beat down as he was from Judge Hoffman and the proceedings, his humor would always penetrate and cut through. And those listening to those recordings was another amazing find, because I was able to put on headphones and feel as if, I was listening in on these rather intimate conversations between Bob and Abby.
Well, let's hear an excerpt of one of those conversations between Bob Fass and Abby Hoffman.
Hi, Abby.
Robert.
Hi.
It's a chilly night here.
Yeah?
Yeah. How are you doing, man?
Okay. How was it in court today?
Oh, it's unbelievable. I mean, our trial is a jewel.
Well, the judge, he's 74 years old. He was alive at the first and second Balkan Wars. I think he just missed going on the Titanic. Yeah, I think he's even beyond the generation gap.
Are you sure you're not related to him?
No.
Are you sure? The name.
I brought him a present, though. What? I heard he had tired blood, and I bought him a year's supply of Geritol.
Do you really think he'd take a thing like that kindly, Abby? Giving him Geritol?
Well, he has a bit of a sense of humor.
He might think of it as an attempt to bribe him.
Well,
I think you probably are relatives in some distant way, Abby.
Some distant way, yeah. In the great conspiracy, we're all sort of relatives.
That's an excerpt of a real broadcast between Abby Hoffman and WBAI radio host Bob Fass, recorded during the Chicago 8 conspiracy trial. And it's featured in the movie Chicago 10, which was made by my guest, Brett Morgan. So, Brett, having made your movie, The Chicago 10, how do you see the whole trial and the events leading up to it differently than you did before you started?
You know, Terry, I didn't have much knowledge of the trial before I started, so I was on a journey of discovery as I made this film. And it was kind of refreshing because I was born in October of 68, and I was able to experience these subjects free of what eventually became of them. And I was able to separate myself from that, which is very different than, most people can't separate what was happening in 69 to the ultimate fates of those subjects. Jerry Rubin became a quote-unquote yuppie. One of the defendants ended up selling life insurance. Abby Hoffman sort of never was quite as significant a character as he was at the trial. The movie's set in 68, but I never thought I was making a film about 1968. I thought I was making a film about today and appropriating the iconography and the imagery from the 60s and these sources from the 60s to tell a story that was ultimately about the time I'm living in and about the war that I'm living through. Not very similar in a way to what Baz Luhrmann was doing in Romeo and Juliet, which is why I'm emphatically say this isn't a history lesson. I think the lesson for me of what the film is ultimately trying to do is tell the audience or ask – put a mirror up to the audience – and challenge them to ask them, how far are you willing to go? And the answer, we're not suggesting that people need to get beat over the heads to make a statement. Ultimately, what the film tells you is that each person needs to make that decision for themselves. And all we're doing is asking them to take a moment to ask, am I doing enough?
Well, Brett Morgan, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Brett Morgan directed the new documentary, Chicago 10. The self-titled debut album by the band Vampire Weekend attracted a lot of attention on the internet and in the media long before its January 29th digital release on iTunes. The Manhattan-based band emphasizes the contrast between its preppy onstage look and its Afro-pop melodies. Rock critic Ken Tucker says the group is an example of the accelerated pace of being considered cool one minute and facing a backlash the next.
Of Ivy League or prep school rock and roll stretch back at least as far as Steely Dan, whose founders Donald Fagen and Walter Becker first teamed up while attending Bard in the late 60s, and one of whose early incarnations included comedian Chevy Chase on drums. Since then, singer-songwriters from James Taylor to Loudon Wainwright III to Loudon's son Rufus have all added flourishes of entitlement, sometimes as self-deprecating satire, more often blithely as their just desserts. Vampire Weekend are four Columbia University grads who take the stage in Brooks Brothers shirts and topsiders and sing about Cape Cod weekends and dressing in, quote, bleeding madras. They have become simultaneously Manhattan's most acclaimed and most overhyped new band.
As a young girl, Louis Vuitton.
That Vampire Weekend song reminded you of Paul Simon's Graceland, as well as decades of what's become known as world music. Well, these vampires have leached ideas from African pop music, Simon's brilliant use of it, and name-check another world music traveler, Peter Gabriel, in that song. The boys in Vampire Weekend are not, in other words, trying to hide anything or pass as authentic. I think it's this quality of clever transparency that's proven so charming and disarming to their young New York City audiences. Mixing Afro-pop guitar lines with a clipped, lurching reggae ska beat on that song, A-Punk, lead singer Ezra Koenig vocalizes plaintively. He's as upfront white bread a cultural explorer as the band's other obvious influence, David Byrne and Talking Heads. But rattling off all their influences doesn't give Vampire Weekend credit for what they bring to the music, which is a pleasing tension between the melodies and their lyrics. The song Oxford Comma is indeed a brief consideration of grammar. The title is a variation on what you may have been taught as the serial comma. Another tune, Mansard Roof, takes an architectural term to summon up memories of what went on inside old university buildings.
I see a mansard roof through the trees. I see a salty message written in the eaves. The ground beneath my feet, the odd garbage and concrete. Now the tops of buildings, I can see them too.
cycle of exposure, the band posted a number of the songs on its MySpace page and built a strong following for its New York area performances. This has led to the New York Times coverage with loving descriptions of their clothes and courtly manners, which in turn, given the speed of pop culture these days, has already led to a backlash, a they're-not-so-hot reaction. But that's always what happens when a band cherished by a cult gets mass exposure. The original fans feel as though their secret has been stolen and don't like being associated with the rabble. And being above the rabble is both Vampire Weekend's least attractive trait and their greatest subject. I wouldn't want to be planning their next career move. It's going to be tricky.
Ken Tucker is editor-at-large at Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed the debut album by Vampire Weekend. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org.